I just say one thing about duty-free shops before I go on to talk about the Scion? It's not that things aren't cheaper in the duty-free shops. They are. Infinitesimally. You do save a very small amount of money if you shop at them. Of course, you can then lose a very hefty sum of money in fines if you fail to realise that you have to declare anything you've bought duty-free to the customs when you come back into the country. The stuff is only really duty-free if you intend to spend the rest of your life on an aeroplane. So what happens when you buy stuff at the duty-free shop for very slightly less than you would in the high street? It means that most of the money saved on duty is going into the coffers of the duty-free shops rather than helping to pay for the National Health Service and Trident. So why did I buy my Scion at the duty-free shop? Because I'm a complete idiot, that's why. Anyway, status update. They've found me a room. I've unpacked my adapter plug. My PowerBook is charging itself up. I'm still not using it, though because I am now lying in the bath. So I'm still using the Scion. I have never ever written anything in the bath before. Paper gets damp and steamy. Pens won't write upside down. Typewriters hurt your tummy. And if you are prepared to use a PowerBook in the bath, then I assume that it isn't your own PowerBook. Well, the thing is, it can be done. You can actually write on a palm-top computer, which is something I didn't realise before. I had tried to do it on a Sharp Wizard, but it wasn't possible because the keyboard was laid out alphabetically, which is hopeless. The principle behind the decision to have an alphabetical keyboard is based on a misunderstanding. I believe that the idea is this. Not everybody knows QWERTY. It's an odd feeling, actually, typing QWERTY as a word. Try it and you'll see what I mean. But everybody knows the alphabet. This is true, but irrelevant. People know the alphabet as a one-dimensional string, not as a two-dimensional array. So you're going to have to hunt and peck anyway. So why not use QWERTY and let people who know it have the benefit? I also tried the larger Sharp Wizard, the 8200, which does have a QWERTY keyboard, but no word wrap. Can you believe that? Even Etch-A-Sketch has word wrap these days. The other problem with all palm tops is, of course, that the keyboard is too small for your fingers. This is a tricky one. You can't win. If the machine's small enough to go in your pocket, it's too small to type on. Well, I found the answer. Forgive me if you knew this already. Perhaps I'm the last person in the world to find this out. Anyway, the answer is this. You grip the palm top between both hands, and you type with your thumbs. Seriously, it works. It feels a bit awkward to begin with, and your hands ache a little from using unaccustomed muscles, but you get used to it surprisingly quickly. I've clocked up 1,000 words now. Now this raises some interesting questions. Well, interesting to me. You can please yourselves. What about this input business, then? I am, of course, as out of my mind with excitement as the next person about the prospect of voice input and pen input, but you know and I know, and anybody who has fooled around with a carey typist or the like will know that things rarely work as smoothly in practice as they do in theory, or at least, not yet. Most of the time spent wrestling with technologies that don't quite work yet is just not worth the effort for end users, however much fun it is for nerds like us. The days when you can say, "Open pod bay number 2, Hal," and be confident that Hal understands that you want to be stranded on the outskirts of Jupiter, are still a way away, and I suspect that it will be a very long time before I am able to dictate an article like this, and for the result to be even decipherable, let alone accurate. We've all seen the old sketch in which a secretary writes down absolutely everything the boss says, including the bit where he says, "Don't write this bit down," or "cross out the last sentence." I think there's going to be a lot of stupid secretary-type grief to go through before we get it working smoothly. As for pen input devices, well, as I said above, 10 years of word processing has meant that my handwriting has deteriorated to the point where even I can't read it, so what chance a computer stands I really don't know. Can I be bothered to tease out the irony involved in all that? No. So for the moment, that leaves us back with the keyboard input. And keyboard input, for the moment, means QWERTY. But QWERTY, as we know, was originally designed to slow down typists so the keys wouldn't jam. It's deliberately inefficient. However, all attempts to replace it with something more efficient, like the Dvorak keyboard, have failed. People know QWERTY already, and they don't have any pressing incentive to change. Dvorak et al. May be better, but QWERTY is, or has been till now, good enough. If it ain't bust, don't fix it, is a very sound principle, and remains so despite the fact that I have slavishly ignored it all my life. I think, though, that we might finally have arrived at a point at which there is a strong incentive to reinvent the keyboard. Palm-top computers are where all the new action is. Apple and Microsoft and everybody are suddenly beginning to get revved up about personal digital assistants and stuff. And having been using this Scion Series 3A for a few hours now, so am I. It's terrific technology, and this is just the beginning. That crucial moment at which something stops being just an entertaining new toy and starts being something you can seriously use in the bath. We've all known for years that QWERTY isn't good. I think we've now got to that important point where it isn't even good enough. I hope that systems designers have not been put off by the failure of the Dvorak keyboard. I hope they are carefully studying the way that people hold palm-top computers, where their fingers naturally fall and fit, and how the whole idea of how a keyboard works can be rethought. I would very much like it if my thumb joints were now not stiff and aching. I've proved it can be done, but, like Branwell Bronte, I'm not expecting to do the same trick again tomorrow. Independent on Sunday. We notice things that don't work. We don't notice things that do. We notice computers. We don't notice pennies. We notice e-book readers. We don't notice books. Little dongly things. Time to declare war, I think, on little dongly things. More of them turned up in the post this morning. I'd ordered a new optical disk drive from an American mail order company, and because I live in that strange and remote place called Foreign, and also because I travel like a pigeon, I was keen to know, when ordering it, if it had an international power supply. An international power supply is the device which means it doesn't matter what country you're in, or even if you know what country you're in. More of a problem than you might suspect. You just plug your Mac in, and it figures it out for itself. We call this principle plug and play. Or at least, Microsoft calls it that because it hasn't got it yet. In the Mac world, we've had it for so long we didn't even think of giving it a name. Nowadays, a lot of peripherals come with international power supplies as well, but not all, which is why I asked. "Yes, it does," said Scott, the sales assistant. "You're sure it has an international power supply?" "Yes," repeated Scott. "It has an international power supply." "Absolutely sure." "Yes." This morning, it arrived. The first thing I noticed was that it didn't have an international power supply. Instead, it had a little dongly thing. I have rooms full of little dongly things and don't want any more. Half the little dongly things I've got, I don't even know what gizmo they're for. More importantly, half the gizmos I've got, I don't know where their little dongly thing is. Most annoyingly, an awful lot of the little dongly things, including the one that arrived this morning, are little dongly things that run on 120 volts AC. American voltage, which means I can't use them here in Foreign, state code FN. But I have to keep them in case I ever take the gizmo to which they fit, provided I know which gizmo it is they fit to the USA. What, you may ask, the hell am I talking about? The little dongly things I am concerned with, and they are by no means the only species of little dongly things with which the microelectronics world is infested, are the external power adapters which laptops and palm tops and external drives and cassette recorders and telephone answering machines and powered speakers and other incredibly necessary gizmos need to step down the mains AC supply from either 120 volts or 240 volts to 6 volts DC, or 4.5 volts DC, or 9 volts DC, or 12 volts DC, at 500 milliamps, or 300 milliamps, or 1200 milliamps. They have positive tips and negative sleeves on their plugs, unless they are the type that has negative tips and positive sleeves. By the time you multiply all these different variables together, you end up with a fairly major industry, which exists, so far as I can tell, to fill my cupboards with little dongly things, none of which I can ever positively identify without playing gizmo Pelmanism. The usual method of finding a little dongly thing that actually matches a gizmo I want to use is to go and buy another, at a price that can physically drive the air from your body. Now, why is this? Well, there's one possible theory, which is just that as Xerox is really in the business of selling toner cartridge, Sony is really in the little dongly power supply business. Another possible reason is that it is sheer blinding idiocy. It couldn't possibly be that, could it? I mean, could it? It's hard to imagine that some of the mightiest brains on the planet, fueled by some of the finest pizza that money can buy, haven't at some point thought, wouldn't it be easier if we all just standardized on one type of DC power supply? Now, I'm not an electrical engineer, so I may be asking for the impossible. Maybe it is a sine qua non of the way in which a given optical drive or CD Walkman works, that it has to draw 600 milliamps rather than 500, or have its negative terminal on the tip rather than the sleeve, and that it will either whine or fry itself if presented with anything faintly different. But I strongly suspect that if you stuck a hardware engineer in a locked room for a couple of days and taunted him with the smell of pepperoni, he'd probably be able to think of a way of making whatever gizmo, maybe even the new Gizmo Pro, which I've heard such good things about, it is he's designing, work to a standard DC low-power supply. In fact, there already is a kind of rough standard, but it's rather an odd one. Not many people actually smoke in their cars these days, and the aperture in the dashboard which used to hold a cigar lighter is now more likely to be powering a mobile phone, CD player, fax machine, or, according to a recent and highly improbable TV commercial, an instant coffee-making gizmo. Because the socket originally had a different purpose, it's the wrong size and in the wrong place for what we now want to do with it, so perhaps it's time to start adapting it for its new job. The important thing this piece of serendipitous pre-adaptation has given us is a possible DC power standard. An arbitrary one, to be sure. But perhaps we should probably just be grateful that it was designed by a car mechanic in an afternoon and not a computer industry standards committee in a lifetime. Keep the voltage level, design a new small plug, and you have a new standard. The immediate advantage of adopting it would be that you would only need one DC power adapter. Think of that! Well, not exactly one, you might need a dozen of them, but they would all be exactly the same, just get a box of them. They'll just be a commodity item, like, well, I was going to say light bulbs, but light bulbs come in all sorts of different wattages and fittings. The great thing about having a DC power standard is that it would be much better than light bulbs. Apart from doing away with endless confusion and inconvenience, the arrival of a new standard would encourage all sorts of other new features to emerge. Power points in convenient places in cars, DC power points in homes and offices, and most importantly, DC power points in the armrests of aeroplane seats. I have to own up and say that much as I love my PowerBook, which now does about 97.8% of what I used to use the lumbering old desktop dinosaurs for, I've given up trying to use it on planes. Yes, yes, I know that there are all sorts of power user strategies you can use to extend your battery life, dimming modes, RAM disks, processor resting, and so on, but the point is that I really can't be bothered. I'm perfectly capable of just reading the in-flight magazine if I want to be irritated. However, if there was a DC power supply in my armrest, I would actually be able to do some work, or at least fiddle with stuff. I know that the airline companies will probably say, "Yes, but if we do that, our aeroplanes will fall out of the sky." But they always say that. I know that sometimes their planes do fall out of the sky, but, and here's the point, not nearly as often as the airline companies say they will. I, for one, would be willing to risk it. In the Great War against little dongly things, no sacrifice, I think, is too great. 1996, Completely Unexpected Productions Limited. We are stuck with technology. When what we want, what we really want, is just stuff that works. How do we recognize something that is still technology? A good clue is if it comes with a manual. What have we got to lose? Some of the most revolutionary new ideas come from spotting something old to leave out, rather than thinking of something new to put in. The Sony Walkman, for instance, added nothing significantly new to the cassette player. It just left out the amplifier and speakers, thus creating a whole new way of listening to music and a whole new industry. Sony's new Handycam rather brilliantly leaves out the zoom function on the grounds that all a zoom does is cost money, add a lot of bulk, and render every amateur video ever made unwatchable. They might, while they're following this line of thought, consider marketing a record-only video player, and video companies might consider releasing movies that are actually recorded in fast-forward mode. The RISC chip works by the brilliant, life-enhancing principle of getting on with the easy stuff and leaving out all the difficult bits for someone else to deal with. I know it's a little more complicated than that, but you have to admit it's a damned attractive idea. A well-made dry martini works by the brilliant, life-enhancing principle of leaving out the martini. You also get dramatic advances when you spot that you can leave out part of the problem. Algebra, for instance, and hence the whole of computer programming, derives from the realization that you can leave out all the messy, intractable numbers. Then there's the new, improved UK Directory Inquiries Service. A couple of years or so ago, something radical changed. When you dialed 192, you actually got a civil, helpful answer. Usually, and here was the clue, delivered in a Scots accent. The whole operation had been rounded up and moved to Aberdeen, where they had a plentiful supply of civil, helpful people who didn't have to be compensated for living in London. Somebody bright at British Telecom had spotted that the location was immaterial. The problem of distance could simply be left out of the model, something they have yet to come to terms with in their pricing structures. With a little extra cable laying, it seems to me that they could have moved UK directory inquiries to St Helena or the Falklands, thus bringing whole new possibilities of employment to areas that were previously limited to the things you could do with sheep. The Falklands could, while they were about it, put in a bid to run Argentina's directory inquiry service as well, which would give the foreign offices of both countries something to think about. Almost everything to do with the net involves spotting the things we can now leave out of the problem, and location, or distance, is one of them. Wandering around the web is like living in a world in which every doorway is actually one of those science fiction devices which deposit you in a completely different part of the world when you walk through them. In fact, it isn't like it. It is it. Trying to work out all the implications of this is as difficult as it was for early filmmakers to work out all the implications of being able to move the camera. What else is going to fall out of the model? Over the last few years, I've regularly been cornered by nervous publishers or broadcasters or journalists or filmmakers and asked how I think computers will affect their various industries. For a long time, most of them were desperately hoping for an answer that translated roughly into not very much. People like the smell of books. They like popcorn. They like to see programs at exactly the same moment as their neighbours. They like, at least, to have lots of articles that they'd no interest in reading, etc. But it's a hard question to answer because it's based on a faulty model. It's like trying to explain to the Amazon River, the Mississippi, the Congo, and the Nile how the coming of the Atlantic Ocean will affect them. The first thing to understand is that river rules will no longer apply. Since you're currently holding a magazine, let's think about what might happen when magazine publishing is no longer a river in its own right, but is just a current in the digital ocean. Magazines are starting to appear on the web, but since they are just a number of interconnected pages in a world of interconnected pages, the boundaries between magazine and not magazine, or indeed between magazine A and magazine B, are, from the web browser's point of view, rather vague. Once we drop the idea of discreetly bound and sold sheaves of glossily processed wood pulp from the model, what do we have left? Anything useful? From the reader's point of view, it's useful in much the same way that a paper magazine is. It's a concentration of the sort of stuff she's interested in a form that's easy to locate, with the added advantage that it will be able to point seamlessly at all kinds of related material in a way that a paper magazine cannot. All well and good. But what about the magazine publisher? What does she have to sell? What's she going to do now that she doesn't have stacks of glossy paper that people are going to want to hand over wads of greenies to acquire? Well, it all depends on what sort of business you think she's in. Lots of people are not in the business you think they're in. Xerox, for instance, is in the business of selling toner cartridges. All that mucking about they do developing high-tech copying and printing machines is just creating a commodity market in toner cartridges, which is where their profit lies. Television companies are not in the business of delivering television programs to their audience. They're in the business of delivering audiences to their advertisers. This is why the BBC has such a schizophrenic time. It's actually in a different business from all its competitors. And magazines are very similar. Each actual sale across the newsagent's counter is partly an attempt to defray the ludicrous cost of manufacturing the damn thing, but is also, more significantly, a very solid datum point. The full data set represents the size of the audience the publisher can deliver to its advertisers. Now, I regard magazine advertising as a big problem. I really hate it. It overwhelms the copy text, which is usually reduced to a dull, grey little stream, trickling its way through enormous, glaring, billboard-like pages, all of which are clamouring to draw your attention to stuff you don't want. And the first thing you have to do when you buy a new magazine is shake it over a bin in order to shed all the coupons, sachets, packets, CDs, and free Labrador puppies, which make them as fat and unwieldy as a grandmother's scrapbook. And then, when you are interested in buying something, you can't find any information about it, because it was in last month's issue, which you've now thrown away. I bought a new camera last month, and bought loads of camera magazines just to find ads and reviews for the models I was interested in. So I resent about 99% of the advertising I see, but occasionally I want it enough to actually buy the stuff. There's a major mismatch. Something is ripe to fall out of the model. If you browse around an online magazine, Hot Wired, for instance, springs unbidden to mind, you will find a few discreet little sponsor icons here and there, which you choose to click on. You only get to see the proper ad if you're actually interested in it, and that ad will then lead you directly towards solid, helpful information about the product. It is, of course, much more valuable for advertisers to reach one interested potential customer than it is to irritate the hell out of 99 others. Furthermore, the advertiser gets astonishingly precise feedback. They will know exactly how many people have chosen to look at their ad and for how long, with the result that an unwelcome ad for something no one's interested in will quickly wither away, whereas one which catches people's attention will thrive. The advertisers pay the magazine for the opportunity to put links to their ads on popular pages of the magazine, and, well, you see the way it works. It is, I am told by people with seriously raised eyebrows, astonishingly effective. The thing which drops out of the problem is the notion that advertising need be irritating and intrusive. That's one model of how online magazines work, and it is, of course, absolutely free to readers. There's another, which will probably arrive as soon as it becomes possible to move virtual cash around the internet, and that will involve readers being billed tiny amounts of money for the opportunity to read popular web pages. Much less than you would, for instance, regularly spend on your normal newspapers and magazines, because you wouldn't have to be paying for all the trees that have to be pulped, the vans that have to be fueled, and the marketing people whose job it is to tell you how brilliant they are. The reader's money goes straight to the writer, with a proportion to the publisher of the website, and all the wood can stay in the forests, the oil can stay in the ground, and all the marketing people can stay out of the Groucho Club and let decent folk get to the bar. Why doesn't all the money go to the writer, I hear you and indeed myself asking? Well, maybe it will, if he's happy just to drop his words into the digital ocean in the hope that someone out there will find it. But like any ocean, the digital one has streams and eddies and currents, and publishers will quickly have a role finding good material to draw into those currents, where readers will naturally be streaming through looking for stuff, which is more or less what they do at the moment. The difference will lie in the responsiveness of the market, the speed with which those streams will shift and surge, and the way in which power and control will shift to those who are actually contributing something useful rather than just having lunch. The thing we leave out of the model is, essentially, just a lot of dead wood. Independent on Sunday. Time travel. Time travel? I believe there are people regularly travelling back from the future and interfering with our lives on a daily basis. The evidence is all around us. I'm talking about every time we make an insurance claim, we discover that somehow, mysteriously, the exact thing we're claiming for is now precisely excluded in your policy. Turncoat. I'm often asked if I'm not a bit of a turncoat. 20 years, help, ago, in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I made my reputation making fun of science and technology, depressed robots, uncooperative lifts, doors with ludicrously overdesigned user interfaces, what's wrong with just pushing them, and so on. Now I seem to have become one of technology's chief advocates, as is apparent from my recent series on Radio 4, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Future. I wish we hadn't ended up with that title, incidentally, but sometimes events have a momentum of their own. Two things. First of all, I wonder if we don't have too much comedy these days. When I was a kid, I used to hide under the bedclothes with an old radio I'd got from a jumble sale and listen enraptured to Beyond Our Ken, Hancock, The Navy Lark, even The Clitheroe Kid, anything that made me laugh. It was like showers and rainbows in the desert. And then there was I'm Sorry I'll Read That Again, and a few short years later, the full glories of Monty Python. The thing about Python that hit me like a thunderbolt, and I really don't give a toss if this ends up in Sued's Corner, was that comedy was a medium in which extremely intelligent people could express things that simply couldn't be expressed any other way. From where I was sitting in my boarding school in deepest Essex, it was a thrilling beacon of light. It's curious to me that the Pythons came along just as those other great igniters of a young imagination, the Beatles, were fading. There was a sense of a baton being passed. I think George Harrison once said something similar. But nowadays, everybody's a comedian, even the weather girls and continuity announcers. We laugh at everything. Not intelligently anymore, not with sudden shock, astonishment, or revelation, just relentlessly and meaninglessly. No more rain showers in the desert, just mud and drizzle everywhere, occasionally illuminated by the flash of paparazzis. Creative excitement has gone elsewhere, to science and technology. New ways of seeing things, new understandings of the universe, continual new revelations about how life works, how we think, how we perceive, how we communicate. So this is my second point. Where, 30 years ago, we used to start up rock bands, we now start up startups and experiment with new ways of communicating with each other and playing with the information we exchange. and when one idea fails, there's another better one right behind it, and another, cascading out as fast as rock albums used to in the 60s. There's always a moment when you start to fall out of love, whether it's with a person, or an idea, or a cause, even if it's one you only narrate to yourself years after the event. A tiny thing, a wrong word, a false note, which means that things can never be quite the same again. For me, it was hearing a stand-up comedian make the following observation. These scientists say, they're so stupid. You know those black box flight recorders they put on aeroplanes? And you know they're meant to be indestructible? It's always the thing that doesn't get smashed. So why don't they make the planes out of the same stuff? The audience roared with laughter at how stupid scientists were. Couldn't think their way out of a paper bag, but I sat feeling uncomfortable. Was I just being pedantic to feel that the joke didn't really work, because flight recorders are made out of titanium, and that if you made planes out of titanium instead of aluminium, they'd be far too heavy to get off the ground in the first place? I began to pick away at the joke. Supposing Eric Morecambe had said it, would it be funny then? Well, not quite, because that would have relied on the audience seeing that Eric was being dumb. In other words, they would have had to know, as a matter of common knowledge, about the relative weights of titanium and aluminium. There was no way of deconstructing the joke. If you think this is obsessive behaviour, you should try living with it. That didn't rely on the teller and the audience complacently conspiring together to jeer at someone who knew more than they did. It sent a chill down my spine and still does. I felt betrayed by comedy in the same way gangster rap now makes me feel betrayed by rock music. I also began to wonder how many of the jokes I was making were just, well, ignorant. My turn towards science came one day in about 1985 when I was walking through a forest in Madagascar. My companion on the walk was the zoologist Mark Carwardine, with whom I later collaborated on the book Last Chance to See, and I asked him, "So come on then, what's so special about the rainforest that we're supposed to care about it so much?" And he told me. Took about 2 minutes. He explained the difference between temperate forest and rainforest, and how it came to be that the latter produced such bewildering diversity of life, but was at the same time so terribly fragile. I fell silent for a few moments as I began to realize that one simple piece of new understanding had just changed the way I saw the world. I had just been handed a single thread I could now follow into the tangled ball of a bewilderingly complex world. For the next few years, I hungrily devoured everything I could lay my hands on about evolutionary science and realized that nothing I'd ever understood about it at school had prepared me for the enormity of what was now swimming into my view. The thing about evolution is that if it hasn't turned your brain inside out, you haven't understood it. Then, to my surprise, I discovered that it was converging with my growing interest in computers. There was nothing particularly profound about that enthusiasm. I just unashamedly love playing with gadgets. The connection lies in the counterintuitive observation that complex results arise from simple causes, iterated many times over. It's terribly simple to see this happening in a computer. Whatever complexities a computer produces, modeling wind turbulence, modeling economies, or the way light dances in the eye of an imaginary dinosaur, it all grows out of simple lines of code which start with adding one and one, testing the result, and then doing it again. Being able to watch complexity blossom out of this primitive simplicity is one of the great marvels of our age, greater even than watching man walk on the moon. It's much more difficult to see it happening in the case of the evolution of life. The timescales are so vast, and our perspective so much complicated by the fact that it's ourselves we're looking at. But our invention of the computer has, for the first time, let us get a real feel for how it works. Just as our invention of the hydraulic pump first gave us an insight into what the heart was doing and how the circulation of the blood worked. This is also why it's impossible to divorce pure science from technology. They feed and stimulate each other. So the latest software gizmo for transferring an MP3 sound file from one computer to another across continents is, when you peer into its innards and at the infrastructure which has given rise to it and which it in turn becomes part of, is in its way every bit as interesting as the way in which a cell replicates, an idea is formed within a brain, or a beetle deep in the heart of the Amazonian rainforest digests its prey. It's all part of the same underlying process that we in turn are part of. It's where our creative energies are being poured. And I'll happily take it over comedians, television, and football, any day. October 2000. Present somebody with a questionnaire clipboard, and they lie. A friend of mine once had a job preparing a questionnaire for people to fill in on the web. He said the information they got back was enormously heartening about the state of the world. For instance, do you know that almost 90% of the population are CEOs of their own companies and earn over $1 million a year? Is there an artificial God? This was originally billed as a debate only because I was a bit anxious coming here. I didn't think I was going to have time to prepare anything, and also, in a room full of such luminaries, I thought, what could I, as an amateur, possibly have to say? So I thought I would settle for a debate. But after having been here for a couple of days, I realized you're just a bunch of guys. It's been rife with ideas, and I've had so many myself through talking with and listening to people, that I'd thought what I'd do was stand up and have an argument and debate with myself. I'll talk for a while and hope sufficiently to provoke and inflame opinion that there'll be an outburst of chair-throwing at the end. Before I embark on what I want to try and tackle, may I warn you that things may get a little bit lost from time to time because there's a lot of stuff that's just come in from what we've been hearing today, so if I occasionally sort of go... I was telling somebody earlier today that I have a 4-year-old daughter and was very, very interested watching her face when she was in her first 2 or 3 weeks of life and suddenly realizing what nobody would have realized in previous ages. She was rebooting. I just want to mention one thing, which is completely meaningless, but I am terribly proud of. I was born in Cambridge in 1952, and my initials are DNA. The topic I want to introduce to you this evening, the subject of the debate that we are about to sort of not have, is a slightly facetious one. You'll be surprised to hear, but we'll see where we go with it. Is there an artificial God? I'm sure most of the people in this room will share the same view, but even as an out-and-out atheist, one can't help noticing that the role of a God has had an enormously profound impact on human history over many, many centuries. It's very interesting to figure out where this came from, and what, in the modern scientific world we sometimes hope against hope that we live in, it actually means. I was thinking about this earlier today when Larry Yeager was talking about what is life, and mentioned at the end something I didn't know about a special field of handwriting recognition. The following strange thought went through my mind, that trying to figure out what is life and what isn't and where the boundary is has an interesting relationship with how you recognize handwriting. We all know when presented with any particular entity, whether it's a bit of mould from the fridge or whatever, we instinctively know when something is an example of life and when it isn't. But it turns out to be tremendously hard exactly to define it. I remember once, a long time ago, needing a definition of life for a speech I was giving. Assuming there was a simple one and looking around the internet, I was astonished at how diverse the definitions were and how very, very detailed each one had to be in order to include this, but not include that. If you think about it, a collection that includes a fruit fly and Richard Dawkins and the Great Barrier Reef is an awkward set of objects to try and compare. When we try and figure out what the rules are that we are looking for, trying to find a rule that's self-evidently true, that turns out to be very, very hard. Compare this with the business of recognizing whether something is an A or a B or a C. It's a similar kind of process, but it's also a very, very different process, because you may say of something that you're not quite certain whether it counts as life or not life. It's kind of there on the edge, isn't it? It's probably a very low example of what you might call life. It's maybe just about alive, or maybe it isn't. Or maybe you might say about something that's an example of digital life. Does that count as being alive? Is it something, to coin someone's earlier phrase, that will go squish if you step on it? Think about the controversial Gaia hypothesis. People say, is the planet alive? Is the ecosphere alive or not? In the end, it depends on how you define such things. Compare that with handwriting recognition. In the end, you are trying to say, is this an A or is it a B? People write A's and B's in many different ways, floridly, sloppily, or whatever. It's no good saying, well, it's sort of A-ish, but there's a bit of B in there, because you can't write the word apple with such a thing. It is either an A or a B. How do you judge? If you're doing handwriting recognition, what you are trying to do is not to assess the relative degrees of A-ness or B-ness of the letter, but trying to define the intention of the person who wrote it. It's very clear in the end, is it an A or a B? Ah, it's an A, because the person writing it was writing the word apple, and that's clearly what it means. So in the end, in the absence of an intentional creator, you cannot say what life is, because it simply depends on what set of definitions you include in your overall definition. Without a God, life is only a matter of opinion. I want to pick up on a few other things that came around today. I was fascinated by Larry again talking about tautology, because there's an argument that I remember being stumped by once, to which I couldn't come up with a reply because I was so puzzled by the challenge and couldn't quite figure it out. A guy said to me, "Yes, but the whole theory of evolution is based on a tautology. That which survives, survives. This is tautological, therefore it doesn't mean anything." I thought about that for a while, and it finally occurred to me that a tautology is something that if it means nothing, not only that no information has gone into it, but that no consequence has come out of it. So we may have accidentally stumbled upon the ultimate answer. It's the only thing, the only force, arguably the most powerful of which we are aware, which requires no other input, no other support from any other place, is self-evident, hence tautological, but nevertheless astonishingly powerful in its effects. It's hard to find anything that corresponds to that, and I therefore put it at the beginning of one of my books. I reduced it to what I thought were the bare essentials, which are very similar to the ones you came up with earlier, which were, anything that happens, happens. Anything that is happening causes something else to happen, causes something else to happen, and anything that in happening causes itself to happen again, happens again. In fact, you don't even need the second two because they flow from the first one, which is self-evident, and there's nothing else you need to say. Everything else flows from that. So I think we have in our grasp here a fundamental ultimate truth, against which there is no gainsaying. It was spotted by the guy who said this is a tautology. Yes, it is, but it's a unique tautology in that it requires no information to go in, but an infinite amount of information comes out of it. So I think that it is arguably, therefore, the prime cause of everything in the universe. Big claim, but I feel I'm talking to a sympathetic audience. Where does the idea of God come from? Well, I think we have a very skewed point of view on an awful lot of things, but let's try and see where our point of view comes from. Imagine early man. Early man is, like everything else, an evolved creature, and he finds himself in a world that he's begun to take a little charge of. He's begun to be a toolmaker, a changer of his environment with the tools that he's made, and he makes tools when he does in order to make changes in his environment. To give an example of the way man operates compared to other animals, consider speciation, which, as we know, tends to occur when a small group of animals gets separated from the rest of the herd by some geological upheaval, population pressure, food shortage, or whatever, and finds itself in a new environment with maybe something different going on. Take a very simple example. Maybe a bunch of animals suddenly finds itself in a place where the weather is rather colder. We know that in a few generations, those genes which favour a thicker coat will have come to the fore. And we'll come and we'll find that the animals have now got thicker coats. Early man, who's a toolmaker, doesn't have to do this. He can inhabit an extraordinarily wide range of habitats on Earth, from tundra to the Gobi Desert. He even manages to live in New York, for heaven's sake. And the reason is that when he arrives in a new environment, he doesn't have to wait for several generations. If he arrives in a colder environment and sees an animal that has those genes which favour a thicker coat, he says, "I'll have it off him." Tools have enabled us to think intentionally, to make things and to do things to create a world that fits us better. Now imagine an early man surveying his surroundings at the end of a happy day's toolmaking. He looks around and he sees a world which pleases him mightily. Behind him are mountains with caves in. Mountains are great because you can go and hide in the caves and you're out of the rain and the bears can't get you. In front of him there's the forest. It's got nuts and berries and delicious food. There's a stream going by which is full of water. Water's delicious to drink. You can float your boats in it and do all sorts of stuff with it. Here's Cousin Ugg, and he's got a mammoth. Mammoths are great. You can eat them. You can wear their coats. You can use their bones to create weapons to catch other mammoths. I mean, this is a great world. It's fantastic. But our early man has a moment to reflect, and he thinks to himself, "Well, this is an interesting world that I find myself in." And then he asks himself a very treacherous question. A question which is totally meaningless and fallacious, but only comes about because of the nature of the sort of person he is, the sort of person he has evolved into, and the sort of person who has thrived because he thinks this particular way. Man the Maker looks at his world and says, "So who made this, then?"
End of side 3B.